Please be seated. So, Denise is in New York visiting our son, and she gets to go to a Broadway play this afternoon. I'm not jealous. But anyway, I have this little tradition that I have tried to keep up over the years whenever she goes away. I make smash burgers and I watch a thriller action flick because she hates those kinds of movies. And you know, I mean, I have to say that they grow a little old. The typecasting, all of that, it just gets to you after a while. But anyway, I keep up my tradition. A recurrent theme in the modern Hollywood action movie is the hero. Usually this comes near the beginning of the movie. Upon a scene where a young woman is being bullied by a group of wannabe tough guys. Usually there's a strong whiff of potential sexual violence, and the hero steps in to save the day, usually by somehow managing to defeat, kill, or maim every single one of the would-be attackers. The woman is left shaking, but deeply grateful, at which point her bruised and battered hero ushers her back into her car and bids her adieu, asking nothing in return. Now, this hero will usually prove himself, shall we say, prolifically testosterone-driven later on in the movie. But in this opening scene, which is supposed to reveal core courage and character, he is nothing if not a chivalrous gentleman. There's a lot this typical scene reveals about North American culture. The prevalence of stereotyped gender roles. Strong males. Monster males. Helpless maidens in distress, and the necessity of violence to solve problems, and the heroic nature of those males willing to practice it to keep the rest of us safe. But now imagine with me a scene in which the maiden in distress meets her hero, and he turns out not a chivalrous gentleman, but the monster. How will this scene unfold? Such is the story that Jesus spins in service of two themes in which Luke names up front: the need to pray always and the need to not lose heart. Now, most of the time we'd say it ruins the story for us to be let in on the lessons in advance. I mean, I do know some people who can't stand the tension of a show or a book, and they turn to the end of the movie or to the end of the book, see how things turn out, and then go back and read the book at a more relaxed pace. I mean, are there any people here willing to fess up to such? Yeah, okay, yeah. Okay, good. I recently had to do this for Denise. She didn't want to continue a novel she was reading because it just didn't seem like it was going to go well. And I fast-forwarded to the end and said, it's okay. Keep going. In the case of Jesus' story, Luke gives us his interpretation of what Jesus is on about, since it's highly unlikely we would guess these themes from the story that follows. The two themes sit uneasily together to our modern minds. To pray always, well, that's seen as a sign of being religious, maybe removed from life's main concerns. It sits in contrast to the theme of self-reliance that is so highly prized as a good, both from what we know of psychology today and our cultural values. To never give up, on the other hand, is associated more with self-reliance. It's more associated with belief in yourself, the pursuit of a goal or a dream, or the dogged determination to use our intelligence and ingenuity in service of the truth and or justice. Luke thinks they should fit together somehow, which has our attention. The story strikes us as a reversal of the cultural trope from the modern action flick. Yes, there is a monster, her opponent. This opponent is not named. We don't know if it's a former husband. We don't know if it's a landlord trying to rent a victor, even though this will consign her to the streets. We don't know. Maybe some other opponent. And, of course, there is this maiden in distress, and yes, there is a third, but instead of being the male hero who comes to her aid, he ends up being another monster. But here's the real reversal. The maiden in distress, the widow, going against these two monsters, if you will, ends up being the heroine alongside God, if you will. She's the example par excellence of prayer, not giving up. And according to the end of the story, the example par excellence of the type of faith that God is looking for. And the kind of faith that actually makes a difference. It's almost like there's a kind of proto-feminism going on, we might say, if you'll permit the anachronism. And this would have been, of course, very radical in the ancient world of Jesus' day. And as our opening illustration reveals, it's still pretty radical in ours. But even given all of that, it's not, to my mind, even the most distressing or radical part of the story. In parables, there's a kind of shape-shifting that can occur. And so characters can kind of shift in and out of focus, and we're not sure who stands for who. But as we begin to read this parable, we wouldn't be wrong to assume that the judge to whom the widow brings her case is meant as a stand-in for God. I mean, God cares for the widow. God cares for the fatherless. Text after text in the Mosaic Law and in the prophets testify to this. Jesus' ministry makes this all very clear. But when the judge, the stand-in for God, turns out not to care for the widow and the fatherless, not be the hero, but an additional foe of basic justice, we're meant to read this in a more complex way. God, it would seem, often appears, is experienced by many of us as part of the problem. Why do our efforts at prayer, at doing good works, or with our neighbors, trying to help them out, seem to encounter such resistance? Why do ordinary people, the poor especially poor women, maybe in our culture we would say, why do trans people find basic justice so difficult to come by? And we might even read the judge as standing in for the church or religious authorities of other faiths who can be seen telling the poor, telling them to just buzz off, to accept their lot in life. God, they're often told, will come at the right time if it's God's will to help you. Cue my opening example again. But till then, just quit bothering us with your claims about fundamental justice. This is an insidious type of theology, Many of us are acquainted with it. Because it leads to faith, in quotes, that vaguely believes in God, vaguely believes that God is helping people and us when things are going well, but that ends up giving up when the hero doesn't appear, when, even according to some of our choruses, we're not rescued when we think we need to be rescued, or when the church turns out to be part of the problem, the block, if you will. But our heroine, this widow, she's having none of it. Her prayer and her faith is real. It touches on real issues in real life and manifests a belief that she matters and that there is help possible, even if the helper, who we might even presume to be God, won't help. She's going to press through that. We would say in this setting, she's not defined by her socioeconomic realities or by the issues pressing down on her. She's not even defined by the theology she's been taught. She's defined, the New Testament, and we might say, by her baptism. She's God's beloved daughter, who by rights expects to participate in God's loving justice. Her complaint is her prayer. Her protest is her prayer. She practices a persistent trust that a God who loves her will yet be manifest through her actions and the circumstances she finds herself in. Shockingly, the story says in effect, and this will be familiar to those of us who have flying experience, you'll remember the announcements at the beginning, put your own oxygen mask on first, and then put it on those next to you who may need help putting it on. The faith that prays always and doesn't give up has experienced the oxygen of God's care for me, for you. If we're going to be those who participate in God's coming reign of loving justice, we must first start with ourselves, or at least, come to realize that our efforts on behalf of others are meant to be applied to us as well. Somehow, maybe in a quiet meditative moment like I was practicing with the children before she headed off to court, maybe wandering towards that courtroom on a dusty road and being aware of a struggling little plant beside the road that persistently exists, keeps growing, even in that harsh environment. Somehow, she's come to believe that the unjust judge is not mediating God's will, though everything in her culture would have told her that was the case. Instead, she has welcomed God's sustaining presence. She has embodied our first reading from Jeremiah. She knows the Lord. She's become aware of a strength that will not let her give up. Now, speaking to all of us, I would say I don't know what opponents you face, whether that's other people or your own inner struggles. Maybe it's the struggle of someone you love very dearly. All I know is that we all have these opponents. The good news of the gospel is that faith is not a superpower. It is not hero strength. It's not an action superhero. In someone else or in you, it is this small seed, it's this small prayer you offer at the beginning of the day as you fall out of bed. It's the bleary Our Father that you mumble in the car on the way to the office, maybe to the doctor's office with your elderly, aging in-law beside you. Maybe it's what you pray when you're in pain or confusion. And it is the persistence of what feels like this very, very small faith that will finally cause your low mood, your despair, your boss, your life to yield, for you to see it differently, even if just by an inch. So, my friends, this is our great privilege, our great challenge, and our faith, the faith of the persistent widow. It is the faith that is possible because it's enabled by God. And it's the only kind of prayer and the kind of faith that really matters. May it be so in this wonderful community, in all of us. Amen.